why you decided to sort of go after him after you saw the videos and see and get a feeling for how this to make a good movie.
Sure. Well, I was a huge fan of this clip, and I originally saw it in 2002 on a VHS tape, and I was just amazed by the performance of the man in the video and how funny he was, to the point where it felt as if it were scripted. It was just unlike anything I'd ever seen before. And then cut to a few years later in 2005 when YouTube was invented, and suddenly clips like the Star Wars kid were being circulated and embarrassing the people that starred in the videos. And the term cyberbullying was being bandied about, and this idea that people could be known in a way that they weren't happy about, and that people were becoming accidental celebrities as a result of this new type of technology, fascinated me. So I thought, well, I wonder how the star of my favorite video is dealing with all these issues. And I innocently started looking around to see what I could find out. And the more I looked, kind of the deeper the mystery became, and the more mysterious Jack Redmi's whereabouts became. And I eventually had to hire a private investigator who traced him to living on top of a mountain in Northern California, completely unaware of the clip's existence or its popularity.
Which is interesting, and you actually do a very good job in the film, I think, of explaining that and trying to, later on in the film, and I don't think I'll be giving anything away when we if we talk about this, is that you were trying to get him to admit something. You were trying to sort of get him to use his sort of interest in intelligence from this fan base that was created, you know, from this crazy video, to use that to, you know, express his views. And he seemed to be very reticent about that. And you kept on staying on that. Is it just when you met the man and you realized sort of who he was after that first initial meeting, which was, as you had said, a little bit of a difference, did you just sort of connect with him and say, look, this guy's voice wants to be heard. I don't want him to be seen as that sort of swearing Winnebago man for the rest of his life?
Well, I wasn't quite so entrepreneurial about it. What happened really was that I'm somebody who is always looking for interesting stories and interesting characters, and I've been making films for about 10 years now. And so I what I realized is that Jack was this really interesting character who found himself with, you know, a very modern dilemma. And so I was always interested in talking with him about that. And once I met him, once I tracked him down and determined that he was alive, I found that he didn't know about the clip's popularity. And so the film becomes about him understanding first that this technology is even possible, that these outtakes from 22 years ago were being watched by tens of millions of people as far away as Japan, you know, which for an 80-year-old man must have just felt like science fiction to a certain extent. But then also, the more I sort of befriended him and came to know him, the more I understood that he was someone who has been writing a novel, has written screenplays, has been trying for a long time to get his beliefs out to whatever degree. And so there comes a point in the film and where I discuss it in voiceover, saying that Jack, you know, really does want to be back on camera again. And this is a very interesting scenario because people expect him to be the Winnebago man, the guy from the, you know, 3.5-minute outtakes clip that's going to rant and rave and swear. But he's much more complicated than that. And I felt some degree of protection for him while making the film. And of course, anybody who knows Jack Redmi immediately understands that you don't need to protect him. In fact, you might need protection from him most of the time. But no, that was really more my motivation rather than to try and get him to be the Winnebago man again.
Well, there was a few scenes in the film where it looked like you needed protection from him.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. He's a big guy, too. That doesn't necessarily come across in the footage. He's, you know, 6'5" and probably 250 pounds at least. And you know, he's an imposing, authoritative figure.
And he's very eloquent in the way he speaks. When
yeah,
he's not swearing.
Very surprising to me, but it makes perfect sense in hindsight that, you know, somebody who can swear that well, you know, really the reason he can do that is because he's so well-spoken and he's so dexterous with the language, and he has a kind of flowery vernacular that is really mesmerizing. It makes, you know, I could listen to him read the cereal box or swear at me or anything in between.
Well, that clip you had about him reading the poem was the only one you found, and you're listening to this poem going, you know, you're getting into listening to it. You may have heard of this poem for so long, but it sounded really good. It was, you know, like the fireside chat.
Exactly. Yeah. He in the film, we talk about the fact that he's been writing a book for the last 5 years, and he is self-publishing it. He's in the process of doing that, and he's going to put it up on Amazon. It's called Jousting with the Myth, and one of the things that I was encouraging him to do was to do an audio recording of the book. But unfortunately, for those of you who have seen the film, he's 81, and he, over the course of filming, he goes completely blind. And so he's not able to read the book and deliver the audio version. But I always thought that would be fun because his voice is just unlike anything I'd ever heard. It's just very melodic and soothing, you know, but also very funny and charming.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about where, like, a couple of things that I think of sort of at the beginning, at the end is, you know, how did he get there? You know, because you had mentioned later on that he, you know, worked for CBS and he was, you know, he was pretty serious in the business, it sounded like, and pretty successful. How did he end up in this little town doing this little sort of industrial video about Winnebagos? You just wonder, how did he end up getting there? And then at the end now, with the fact that the glaucoma's kicked in and, you know, he's supposed to be a caretaker of this area, is he able to stay there? Do they need to find a new caretaker? Is he able to stay in his home?
Oh, no. He wants to stay on top of the mountain for as long as he possibly can. And he has neighbors that, you know, one woman takes him grocery shopping once a week, and the other one cleans his house once a month, and he lives in his cabin, and he takes Buddha for walks, and he listens to the BBC all day long and drinks lots of coffee and has lots of friends that he talks to on the phone. And I'm now included in that group. He and I talk on the phone every single day, and we have for about the last 2.5 years.
Wow.
So we've developed this really unlikely friendship as a result of making the film, and you also see that over the course of shooting, that we really sort of grow to understand each other, and we laughingly refer to the film as Tuesdays with Maury crossed with I don't know if I can say this on the radio. Can I curse on your show?
Not really.
Not really. Okay, well,
if we could, I would have got both of you on the show.
That's right. Well, Tuesdays with Maury crossed with Bleep, My Dad Says.